Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 23rd, 2011. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week's show is all about the year in science, featuring the breakthrough of the year, the nine runners-up, and a few areas to keep an eye on in 2012. Plus, we'll talk about some other big stories in science news this year, including the 2011 highlights from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
At the end of each year, science's editors and news staff settle on a breakthrough of the year. It's always been a tough decision. It must cover new ground in solving a long-standing problem while being accessible and of interest to a wide array of people. This year's breakthrough is an idea, backed up by findings from a recent study, that shows that something we already have can be used for much more in combating a global health crisis. Contributing correspondent John Cohen told me all about it from his office in San Diego.
Breakthrough of the Year is a study with HIV that showed how treating people prevented the spread of the virus. It's something that people have thought was happening, but now there's formal proof of it, and it actually overhauls how people think about HIV prevention.
So what you're saying is that even though HIV treatment is not necessarily 100% effective, that it actually prevents HIV from being spread from infected people?
Oh, no, the treatment's extremely effective in terms of helping people who are infected with the virus stave off illness. It is 100% effective in a sense, but what was unknown was if you treat people, do they become less infectious? And there was a study done in nearly 2,000 couples in which one person was infected at the start of the study and the other wasn't. And they asked, if you treat a person, does that reduce the likelihood that they'll transmit the virus to their long-term partners? And the study found that it reduced the risk of infection by 96%. It was a phenomenal achievement.
Wow. And this is something that we've suspected for a while. What has happened when people have tried to come out and make this statement in the past?
Well, there have been robust debates about it because it really influences policy and how the world should attempt to end epidemics in locales, if not the world itself. And people who were skeptical said, show me the data. Show me the proof. Now the data is so ironclad, there is no more debate. Treatment is prevention. It's not going to solve the epidemic in and of itself, but combined with other prevention advances over the past few years, it's created a whole new dialogue about how to approach ending epidemics.
So this particular study then that came out, it was done by the HIV Prevention Trials Network. How did they set this up?
Well, it's a network set up by the National Institutes of Health in the United States, and they enrolled people in nine different countries around the world, and one partner had to be infected at the start, and they had two groups of people. In one group, they started treatment immediately. In the other, they waited until the infected partner's immune system really showed serious damage. And what they showed is that early treatment both helped the infected person stave off disease and reduce the transmission. And it was nearly 100%. I mean, 96% is phenomenally high. Mm-hmm. You very rarely see that in any HIV prevention trial of anything.
And so it's assumed that within these couples that they're having unprotected sex?
Yeah, they are counseled to use condoms. But you know, in a lot of the world, their desire to have children overwhelms their concern about transmitting the virus. That's just a reality. And it's also difficult for people to use condoms 100% of the time. They just have trouble doing it. And in many situations, a woman has no control over it. So at the end of the day, what this study says is, yes, these people chose not to use condoms.
Now, 96%, that is an absolutely huge number. And you even referred to this as ironclad earlier. I mean, how definitive are these results? Can they be disputed?
Well, it's not that they can be disputed, but they can be compromised in the real world. This was a clinical trial. People were highly motivated to take the drugs. In the real world, it's going to be much more complicated to reach that level of protection. And in addition to that, the world has difficulty right now getting anti-HIV drugs to everyone who needs them as treatment. So how can countries afford this? That's a huge question. Mm-hmm. And do countries have the doctors and nurses on the ground to deliver the drugs? And do they have the testing mechanisms in place to routinely test people to see whether they're infected? All of those things are huge hurdles.
Absolutely. Yeah, these are some of the biggest challenges of this sort of thing. So now that we've made this game-changing finding, what are the next steps in overcoming these challenges and getting this idea of treatment as prevention out on the ground?
Well, the practical challenge is, how do you target this? And the push right now is, let's get everybody treatment who needs it for their own health first. Let's do that. And that's going to require both wealthy nations contributing more to things like the Global Fund, or the U.S. has its PEPFAR program, and middle-income and low-income countries committing more of their own funds to getting this job done. This is doable. I mean, the amazing thing is, we have a tool that we know works. It's now a question of political will and people reaching into their bank accounts and paying for it.
Now, why has it taken us so long to figure this out?
Well, I think one thing that people who aren't in the field don't realize is how much failure this field has suffered through. So many prevention efforts have not worked when put to a real rigorous test in a clinical trial. And over the past 18 months or so, that the field has had four major successes. This is one of four successes. It's not a standalone, hey, this is the end of the epidemic. That's not what it is at all. But it is a turning point, because you have political leaders like Barack Obama saying, we can now create an AIDS-free generation. We can now do this. You couldn't have said that a year ago with a straight face. You couldn't have. It would have been a folly, because the evidence didn't exist. Now the data exists to say, okay, it can be done. And it's now a question of whether the world has the will and the muscle and the money to do it.
Well, it's truly inspiring. John Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
John Cohen showcases the notion of HIV treatment as HIV prevention in an article in this week's special issue of Science. You can read about the breakthrough of the year, as well as other stories on the year in science, and watch a video presentation on the breakthrough and runners-up at www.sciencemag.org/special/BTOY2011. HIV treatment as prevention wasn't the only important breakthrough in 2011. In fact, Science's editors and news staff have also constructed a list of 9 runners-up. We'll take you on a quick tour through a few of these runners-up with a little help from our news staff, who highlight all of these findings in a video we've posted online. The field of malaria prevention has seen its fair share of failures, but a field trial this year saw its first glimpse of success, a prevention rate of about 50%. Science contributing editor Martin Inserink puts it into perspective.
Given the long and frustrating history, it's a start. And researchers can build on this vaccine to design maybe others that do better.
Meanwhile, the Kepler Observatory has been scanning the cosmos for extrasolar planets, and it's found a jackpot. The 700 exoplanets it spotted include planets far too close to their sun, some spinning in opposite directions from their sun, and a few without a sun altogether, many of which defy the physical laws of planet formation we thought were etched in stone. Science news writer Yudhijit Bhattacharjee sums it up.
These discoveries are showing that planetary systems have a chaotic history, a violent history, that researchers are only now beginning to understand.
Going back in time, studies of DNA in modern humans and the remains of Neanderthals and Denisovans reveal that we didn't simply wipe them out, as was commonly thought. As Science contributing correspondent Anne Gibbons points out, the picture is much more complicated.
So it's very interesting. We carry a small amount of DNA, between, say, 2 and 10% of our DNA, from archaic people that we interbred with on at least 3 different continents.
And cell biologists have shed new light on how senescent cells, cells that have gone into permanent hibernation, influence the process of aging. Mice treated with a drug that clears out senescent cells from the body lived healthier lives than untreated mice, without many normal age-related pathologies like cataracts and muscle weakness. Science Deputy News Editor John Travis brings us the next steps.
It's not clear that we can target senescent cells in people, but if we can figure out a way, we might be able to live healthier, if not longer.
To find out more about these stories and others, check out a free video with commentary from our news staff at video.sciencemag.org.
the past 12 months, a few stories have made such a buzz in the news that they may have sounded like candidates for Breakthrough of the Year, or at least runner-up. But don't worry, we haven't forgotten about them. Instead, as Science Deputy News Editor Robert Kuntz explains, they've simply been added to the list of areas to watch in 2012. I began by asking him about those elusive, faster-than-light neutrinos.
This is the one that everybody is asking me about. All my relatives over Thanksgiving, everybody wanted to know, what about those neutrinos? Well, the reason they're not a breakthrough of the year is that they haven't really been discovered yet. People have noticed something anomalous. Scientists who are shooting neutrinos from a lab in Switzerland, CERN, to an underground lab in Italy, noticed that they arrived about 60 nanoseconds, 60 billionths of a second faster than they would have arrived if they were going at the speed of light. Well, there are a lot of things that could go wrong with the measurement. And a lot of people are going to be testing this, trying to figure out exactly what happens. Physicists are very reluctant to scrap Einstein's special relativity because it's a very reliable theory that's been extremely useful for a long time. So they're going to be looking very closely at their experimental setup. Meanwhile, scientists at labs in America are going to be trying to do similar experiments to see if they can reproduce the results. So it's not a breakthrough yet. It's really interesting if it's true. And we're hoping to find out more about it in 2012.
And so the other very, very tiny elephant in the room is the Higgs boson. A lot of press coverage of that, but maybe not a lot of information out there yet.
And that was very strange because this month, reporters from all over the world went to the CERN lab near Geneva for this big announcement of results that have to do with the Higgs boson. And they have two experiments there that are looking for particles that would indicate that this all-important master particle that would explain why things have mass, you know, whether it's really there and how much it weighs. They announced some interesting results that perhaps in retrospect will turn out to have been caused by the Higgs boson, but they're not ready to say they found it yet. There's just too much noise. Now, we're pretty sure that this next year, they're going to find it. If things keep going the way they're going and they keep taking data at the rate they're taking them now, they'll have enough statistics sometime within the next year to figure out whether the Higgs boson is there, and it's looking as if it probably will be, and to get at least an initial estimate of what it's like.
That's exciting. Just to kind of switch gears here for a minute, another area to watch we're looking at is whole genome sequencing with a focus on pathogenic bacteria. Can you tell us why that might be of interest to our readers next year?
You can put it into concrete terms. I think you remember that there was an E. coli outbreak in Germany, and everybody was wondering, where is this stuff coming from? What is it that people are eating that are infecting them? And then same thing happened after the Haitian earthquake when there was this huge cholera outbreak that was traced back to one of the relief teams. One of the main tools that was used to find out where these microbes were coming from that were causing these diseases was genetic analysis. They just found subtle differences in their genes that allowed them to trace them back to their source. We're going to see a lot more of that because as genome sequencing becomes cheaper and more effective, it'll become easier and easier for people just to do this on the fly. As these epidemics are in progress, they'll be able to do an instant genetic analysis, find out the source of these diseases. We saw a couple of examples of that this year. We think that we're going to see much more refined and faster techniques in 2012 and in years to come.
Another area to watch is treating genetic disease in humans, and this is Fragile X, Rett syndrome, and Down syndrome. There's some indication that there might be clinical trials in the works for those. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Now, these are all different kinds of genetically caused developmental disorders that cause different kinds of mental deficits. It can be autism. It can be different kinds of retardation. And in people, some of them have been traced to a deficit of certain proteins, imbalances in neurotransmitters. And they know in many cases which gene is involved, which chromosomes are involved, and in some cases they've managed to get similar disorders in mice. So these mouse models have given clues to what may be going in human beings. And in some cases they've actually managed to cure these things in mice, or at least to some extent. Now, just this year, the Swiss company Roche has started clinical trials of a drug for Down syndrome. They're going to see if these drugs that work in mice can help to counteract some of the effects of Down syndrome in human beings. It'll be great if they can do that. It's a real hope for these disabilities that have never had a treatment until now. So we're watching for that. That's one of our areas to watch.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about cell metabolism and stem cells. This is an area to watch for next year. What are scientists going to do to stem cells now?
The neat thing about stem cells is that they can turn into any kind of cell in the body. They are these undifferentiated cells that can go just in any direction. So, of course, the question is, what causes them to turn into one kind of cell rather than another? Scientists are figuring out the details of just what sends stem cells down a particular route. And it all has to do with very, very esoteric differences in the chemical environment, the chemicals they're exposed to, basically the sorts of things that they eat. This is very esoteric stuff. Scientists are finding out a lot of details, and we think that in 2012, they're going to find out a lot more about just exactly what causes cells to have one fate rather than another. And of course, this has huge implications for the ability to create human cells, to repair damaged ones, all sorts of medical implications.
Finally, let's go to outer space. The Curiosity's mission to Mars. What can you tell us is going to happen in 2012?
Well, Curiosity was launched in November. The whole mission is called the Mars Science Laboratory, and part of it is the Curiosity rover, which is like the Spirit and Opportunity rovers that we've all heard so much about, that we're crawling all over Mars and looking at rocks. The difference is that this rover is about five times as big. It has 10 times as many scientific instruments on it. And what it's going to be trying to do is looking for environments on Mars that might support life. Now, it's not designed to detect life on Mars. It's not going to find the Martians, but it's going to find places where the Martians, if they are anything like life on Earth, could survive. But we're very curious about this. You know, there are a lot of ideas that if there is life on Mars, it will actually look a lot like life on Earth because it probably started on one planet and spread to the other one through meteors. So we don't know which way it could have gone, but the Curiosity laboratory will be up there looking for it. Now, it will land in August. It'll have to be a really, really precise landing. And it's headed for a place called Gale Crater, which is sort of hard to land on. One reason that we're going to be sort of on the edge of our seats to see how this comes out is that Mars missions in the past have had a pretty bad track record, about a 50% success rate. The Russians were just launching one to the Martian moon. It didn't get out of Earth orbit. We're hoping that this Mars Science Lab will make the trip and land successfully and tell us all sorts of interesting things about Mars.
Great. Well, I really look forward to talking to you about these next year.
I'll be back.
You can read more about our 2012 areas to watch in this week's special issue. Breakthroughs aside, 2011 has been a big year in science news. Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis takes us on a retrospective of some of the biggest stories our news editors have put into print.
Well, I think it was a good year for science in this respect, that despite all the concern about the economy and the recession, budgets both in the U.S. and throughout Europe and most of Asia held up pretty well. A lot of projects that scientists were concerned about actually came through. The Webb telescope, for example, which was threatened. This is the successor to Hubble because the cost has gone up so much. Looked like it was in jeopardy, but by the end of the year, it's been saved. Likewise for the big international fusion reactor in France called ITER. That was a project that is costing more and getting delayed, but at the end of the year, the European Union found about almost $2 billion more to be able to continue the project. So all of that is good news for the advance of science. At the same time, there's a lot of cases where scientists behaved badly or at least got into questionable practices.
What kinds of questionable practices or circumstances are we talking about?
Well, there were a couple of very notorious cases, one involving a researcher named Judy Mikovits and an institute in Nevada. She did research showing in mice that a virus seemed to play a role in chronic fatigue syndrome. This was something that the patient community embraced because they've been looking for causes for this disease. Unfortunately, those findings have been discounted. It's turned into a soap opera, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. She has been arrested and charged with some theft of scientific material. The whole case is still in the courts, and it's frankly quite an embarrassment. In a similar vein, there was a finding a year ago that there's a bacterium, perhaps, that uses arsenic instead of phosphorus in its DNA. This was a huge boon for people looking for extraterrestrial life because it meant that it's possible that the human-based structure of DNA could be altered and life could still exist. However, this research has also not been replicated, and by the end of the year, there were serious questions about whether this was a solid finding and whether it had significance for alien life. So those are unfortunate cases.
And as I understand, there were some scientists on trial in Italy as well.
Yes, that trial is going on, and it's a rather interesting case because it focuses with whether scientists should have been able to warn the Italian public prior to an earthquake in April of 2009 in Aquila. It's not a question of can you predict earthquakes, because scientists can't, and I think the general public understands that. But the authorities in Italy felt that the scientists had downplayed the risk from several precursor quakes before the big one. And after the big one hit, they charged the scientists with manslaughter because of the deaths that occurred in the course of the quake. So that trial started last fall. It's probably going to go on for several months, if not a year, but the community is very interested in the results. And then there's controversies. Another case that's been in the courts has to do with federal funding. This is in the United States for embryonic stem cell research. And this is a case that's also gone on for a couple of years in which there was an injunction prohibiting federal support for stem cell research. And then the injunction was overturned by the same judge. And now it's gone to the appellate court and will probably end up in the Supreme Court.
And then changing pace a little bit, in the world of physics, we had an end of an era.
Yes. Well, the world's largest, most powerful collider, the Tevatron at Fermilab in Illinois, closed in September after a more than 25-year run, and it has passed the mantle to the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Europe, and that's where the forefront of particle physics is going to be happening for the next several years. At the same time, that emphasizes the importance of international facilities. There's a large array of telescopes in the high desert in Chile called ALMA, and that's a joint project of the United States, Japan, and the European Union, and I think that's definitely where large science is headed because of the sheer cost of operating these facilities. It's more than any one country can afford.
And speaking of peering into the cosmos, we have quite a few news items from sort of the otherworldly spectrum.
Well, this was a busy year in space. Again, sort of the end of an era in the beginning. The U.S. space shuttle program ended. The last flight took place in July, and for the next several years, the U.S. won't have a capability of sending humans into space without the help from the Russians. At the same time, the Chinese space program is moving ahead very rapidly. They celebrated the first docking of two modules in space, and this is an important achievement for their technical capabilities.
So I think that one news item that we haven't talked about yet, but has really probably had some of the most headlines out there, is the earthquake that occurred in Japan earlier this year. So what's happening with that at this point?
Right. Well, this was, of course, a huge human tragedy, but it was also quite a shock to the scientific community, whose best predictions of the size of an earthquake in that part of the world, and indeed in that part of Japan, were taken by surprise. The size was larger. The tsunami that was triggered was unexpected. It, of course, flooded the nuclear power plant, leading to all kinds of problems there. But it also triggered new interest in paleo-tsunamis. In other words, tsunamis that had happened in the distant past, and whether scientists could find evidence of these and obviously use those to help understand what might happen in the future. So it has put the nuclear power industry back on its heels, and there's questions about whether that will be able to go forward in Japan and around the world. At the same time, it's opened up new scientific frontiers.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about that and seeing what sort of exciting things happen in science in 2012. Jeffrey Mervis, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Carrie. We will try to follow them and bring them to you as they happen.
That was Jeffrey Mervis, reviewing some of the top stories of the past year in science and science policy.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of the best of the Science Now site for 2011. But not all the stories are going to make it into the podcast.
Right, exactly. We're only going to tease you a little bit. I'm going to give you, we actually picked 10 of our favorite stories of the year, and these are a mix of some of our personal favorites plus some of the stories that were our most popular of the year.
Well, let's start with one that I found very interesting, the oldest commercial record. That's kind of a strange record to hold, you know.
It's a very strange record, and it's a very strange noise. Listen to this. Now, what you're hearing there, Sarah, is what may be the oldest recording from a commercial record ever made. This is a woman, if you couldn't make it out, singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, and the record it belongs to is 123 years old.
Wow. Is it a record?
It is a record. It's a record, exactly. Although this thing doesn't really look like a record. It kind of looks like a warped cylinder. You can actually see a picture of it on the site. But this was one of my favorite stories, too, just because it's got a lot of history in there. There's some history with Thomas Edison and how some of the first records were made. But anyways, it's a really fascinating story. There's some science in it. There's some history. And there's really got a lot for everybody. So highly encourage you guys to check that one out.
Well, that sounds really neat for the history buffs. But how about for the people who are fans of traveling abroad?
Right. Well, this next story is about traveling abroad. It's also about scientists that sometimes bring their work home with them. And this is a fascinating story about a researcher who went to Senegal, came back home, had sex with his wife, and it turns out that he transmitted a virus known as the Zika virus to his wife. Now, what's fascinating about the story is that the Zika virus is this really obscure insect-transmitted virus, and researchers have long thought that insect-borne diseases could not be transmitted from human to human via sexual intercourse. Now, no one had actually conducted the study on purpose, but what's really cool about this paper is that the study was actually kind of conducted by accident. And a lot of extenuating circumstances over the next year led the researchers to figure out this is exactly what happened.
Now, I noticed that the wife is actually a co-author on the paper.
Right.
So maybe she wasn't happy about it to begin with, but she did get a writing credit.
She was not thrilled about it, but at least she got some credit for it. Exactly.
So another mystery solved this year. The Hubble confirms the identity of a green blob.
Right. This is another mystery, Sarah, but this mystery is in outer space. It doesn't deal with a virus. And this blob is an object that was seen in 2007 by a Dutch school teacher named Hanny van Arkel. And the object became known as Hanny's Foldworp, if I'm saying that right. There's a bit of a Dutch accent on there that I'm probably not exactly getting right.
And what does Foldworp mean?
It basically means object. So it means Hanny's object. This green blob in space has been a mystery ever since Hanny first saw it in 2007. Well, just this past year, Hubble scientists did some more examination of it, and they found out what it is. I won't give you all the details, but basically it's caused by the radiation from a dying quasar illuminating a giant cloud of hot gas.
Well, the next story is about a very unusual relationship. This one between a bat and a carnivorous pitcher plant that
isn't really that carnivorous in a sense.
Right, right. Well, most carnivorous pitcher plants or most carnivorous plants, we think of the Venus flytrap and other plants, they eat by capturing insects and other animals. Pitcher plants that a fly or another insect will go into the pitcher will be sticky or something else will happen, the insect won't be able to escape. Well, researchers found this unusual plant in Borneo that should make its living catching insects, but it was very bad at it. They weren't finding a lot of dead insects inside this plant. They're like, how does this carnivorous plant survive if it's not eating insects? Well, the kind of gross answer to that question is that it has sort of become a toilet for bats. After much investigation, researchers found bats sleep in these plants overnight. When the bats left in the morning, they had left a, well, let's just say they had left a deposit. And that deposit is actually very nutritious, contains a lot of proteins, a lot of other elements that the plant would otherwise have a hard time getting. So although it sounds gross to us, this plant has evolved a very unique way of surviving.
If you're still listening after that explicit description of the bathroom habits of a bat, we have a more party-oriented story to talk about, the physics of wine swirling.
Right, and this is actually some science you can try at home, especially if you're what's called an enophile, which is basically a wine expert. People have seen, or perhaps you do, swirl your wine around in a glass.
I do.
I don't. I'm not as sophisticated. But the reason people do this is because it mixes the oxygen well with the wine and it enhances the flavor. But nobody really knew exactly what was going on sort of on a physical level. And so in this new study, researchers actually created some mathematical models, believe it or not, of wine swirling. And you can actually see a video of some of these models playing out on the site. And what they found out is there's a bunch of waves, for lack of a better word, that are created in a wine glass when we swirl the wine around. And these waves interact with each other, and they themselves are what sort of helps oxygenate the wine and really sort of helps give wine that flavor that it gets when you swirl it around. The researchers actually went a step further, and if you've ever spilled wine on yourself, and I know I have, they actually created some models for that as well and figured out why that happens.
So there's some parameters that I can, you know, calculate so that I will not spill wine on myself while swirling.
They're pretty complicated parameters, but yes, if you've got the skills to figure out exactly what they're talking about here and you've got all the variables you can plug into the equation, I think you can prevent yourself from spilling wine onto yourself. At least that's my understanding.
That's some good news for the holidays. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing those five with us. I hope people will go check out the rest of them on the site.
I hope so, too. And just to give you an extra enticement, I haven't discussed our number one story of the year. And it's our number one story not because it was only a personal favorite, but it was actually our most read story of all time. So to figure out what that story is, plus read all of our other stories that I didn't discuss here, plus see our Year in Pictures, which is our collection of some of our favorite science illustrations of the year, you'll have to visit the site.
David Grimm, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news, more of the best of 2011, and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org. Remember, you can find all of our coverage of the Breakthrough of the Year, the Runners-Up, and other reviews of the year in science at www.sciencemag.org/special/BTOY2011.
And that concludes the December 23rd, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.